So today on the podcast, I have a friend of mine named Mark. And Mark, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Hey, Lane. So I go to Wright State University. I'm in my third year. I'm studying social science education. I live in Springfield. And I'm almost to graduation, and that's something I'm really, really wanting to get to. But yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. So the topic of the podcast is politics. And so why don't you tell me a little bit about your political story, how you came to the political belief that you have now, what events in your life has shaped your political mindset?
Okay. Yeah. Well, growing up, my father was on the Republican committee here in Clark County, so politics were definitely not foreign to the household. He would have Fox News on just about every night, and sometimes I'd watch it with him. I'd say I started to become more politically aware, strange enough, at about fourth grade. It was the 2008 McCain-Obama election, and like I said, I was in fourth grade, so I wasn't too knowledgeable about anything, but, you know, that's kind of a time where I would kind of just spout off what I'd hear from my dad and from the news that was coming through the house. So I remember we did a mock election, a mock presidential election, and, you know, Obama versus McCain, who was going to win. And I don't remember who won in the elementary school mock election. Of course, it had no bearing on anything in real life, but that's something, that's where I started to at least pay attention a little bit to what was going on. And then the next election rolled around and I really didn't care. By then I was in middle school and I had other things to worry about, I guess. But the 2016 election was the first election I was old enough to be able to vote in. And like I said, I'd always kind of been more on conservative beliefs, Republican values, things like that. So I paid attention to the candidates over there. And I didn't ignore the Democrat candidates. I remember it was primarily between Hillary and Bernie. I don't remember. Biden didn't even try to run, I don't think, in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there was a whole hodgepodge of Republicans. There's 8 to 10, I think. Really, it's more similar to the Democrats for this election cycle. Like, kind of more people up to get nominated. But I kind of honed in on Rand Paul, of all the candidates, and that he was he's still a senator from Kentucky. He wasn't ever polling really high, but I was really behind him. I thought he sounded at least the most knowledgeable about what he was talking about. What he said really resonated with me. I could tell that by then I was starting to drift more over to the libertarian camp, we'll call it. So Rand Paul was definitely out of all the mainstream Republican candidates, I felt like he was the one that most accurately represented what I thought. And so I followed him for a while, and then I think February of 2016 is when he dropped out. And I was pretty bummed out. And then I remember hearing Donald Trump announcing that he was going to run for Republican. And, you know, at first I thought he was just doing it for the meme. I really didn't think he was a serious candidate. And it was really surprising how fast he caught steam and everything. I didn't think anybody was going to be interested in him. But, of course, he eventually got the nomination through whatever means necessary, I guess. And I didn't want to vote for him. I really didn't think he was very Republican, let alone, in general, an individual that I wanted to put my support behind. Now, that being said, I didn't want to vote for Hillary either. Mm-hmm. She and her supporters, or at least her beginning supporters at the time, I felt, were kind of condescending towards the Republican camp. And I feel like that's part of which what got Trump elected was some individuals on the Democrat side or on the left, or however you want to call it, were kind of condescending and, you know, referring to Trump's main supporters like in flyover states, kind of feeling like they're being delegitimized or condescended towards. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's kind of what built up the Trump machine. But by then, I was kind of behind Gary Johnson. He was the Libertarian candidate. That's actually who I ended up voting for.
Oh, nice.
And overall, I still wasn't fully behind him. And I don't really like the lesser of two evils notion mm-hmm. when it comes to actually voting. I believe you should only vote for somebody if they really have your full support, or even most of it, if you can't agree on somebody with everything, of course. But even with him, he just kind of seemed a little kooky. I mean, he seemed nice enough, and a lot of his policies I agreed with, but really, overall, I wasn't really fully behind him either, but I ended up voting for him. Mm-hmm. And I had discussions with friends about that. Most of my friends were more right-wing, more Republican. And, you know, before the election, nobody really thought Donald Trump would win. So, you know, you hear somebody voting for a third party, the usual response is, hey, you're giving the election to the other party. Well, if I don't support any of the mainstream candidates, why would I want any of them to win, I guess? Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't I just vote my conscience? So that's where I ended up with that. And coming up now, I'm just kind of lost. There's really no candidate that has any of my support. There's really not any prominent libertarians that are up for that. And I wouldn't necessarily call myself a libertarian. At least mm-hmm. I'm not a card-carrying party member. I definitely gravitate more towards that libertarian school of thought. I guess the classical liberal school of thought. But I don't know. I guess I, if I had to refer to myself, I'd call myself an independent. But yeah.
Okay. Yes. Yeah,
that's me. I guess.
No, very cool. And I think so. Let's delve into the libertarian mindset for a little bit, right? So let's say somebody listening to this has never even heard that word before. What is the best way that you could describe a libertarian to somebody who may not be familiar with it?
I guess if I had to describe a libertarian, it would be somebody who advocates for maximum personal and economic freedom. So no low taxes, legal drugs, marijuana, gay marriage, everything, advocating for those, just maximum personal and financial freedom, and just wanting the government out of the way in most every aspect of their life. So fiscally conservative, socially liberal, I guess is how people will call it. I think I can agree with that definition. So kind of a mixture of some aspects on either side of the aisle, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. So you said a lot of really interesting things before that I kind of want to touch on a couple at a time. I think one of the main points you brought up is the fact that, yeah, I feel like a lot of the media coverage, especially this election cycle, it's really just down to Trump and whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be. I have yet to see, I think, a debate with third-party candidates. I mean, I assume they're out there, but what do you think about that? Like, what do you think about the media's coverage on other parties?
Well, I felt honestly like they did a good job in 2016. I saw a lot more from Gary Johnson than I would have expected. And I think at the end of the day, the goal of the Libertarian Party in that election was at least to get their candidate polling at 10%. I think that was what a lot of people talked about, just so it could become a little more mainstream. Mm-hmm. And I think he polled at like 3%. But the problem with the media coverage with Gary Johnson is he had a couple of slip-ups, like the Aleppo thing, where some interviewer brought up Aleppo, which is a city in Syria, and he wasn't sure what it was. And of course, you can't expect everybody to know, you know, major geographical things, but there was like a, you know, conflict going on in the area at the time. So I felt like that didn't necessarily help his cause because people saw that and thought he was misinformed. But of course, your average American, and probably at the time Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, couldn't have told you where Aleppo was.
Right.
And I think he stuck his tongue out in another interview. Like I said, he's just kind of a strange guy. But now, I don't know. I haven't heard anything from the party. There's a few different candidates, and I can't think of one of them. John McAfee, I think his name is, or something. He's one. I follow a couple of these guys on Twitter. That's the only reason I know about them. But I don't know if they've selected a specific candidate yet. Now, whoever their candidate is will probably be on the ballot in all 50 states. Mm-hmm. And usually that's the first time a lot of people are going to be hearing about them. But I feel like how the debates are structured, like how you get on the stage, it doesn't allow us to have multiple third party members. Like in 2016, Gary Johnson and I believe it was Jill Stein who was running for the Green Party. Mm-hmm. They both tried to get on the main debate stage, but they weren't polling at high enough numbers, and they weren't they weren't polling at high enough numbers. And I think the Libertarian Party and the Green Party are at least well known enough to where they should at least receive spots on the debate stage, because they don't have all the money from corporate donors, or, you know, they're not billionaires, so they can't pay their way around the country, get their advertisements out. They can't buy YouTube like Mike Bloomberg.
Right?
They can't get their ads out like that all the time. So I feel as if both the major third parties, Libertarian and Green Party, if they were just given a spot on the debate stage, that would just get their word out a lot more. That would just get their faces out there. And I feel like they'd poll higher if they even had a chance to get on the main debate stage. But yeah.
No, and I completely agree with you. I think it is strange that they have these arbitrary things, and then Mike Bloomberg just comes on. He's like, oh, here's some money, and I'm on the stage. Like,
yeah. Exactly what happened with him. He bought his way on that debate stage. I mean, it's pretty entertaining watching him up there kind of get attacked by everybody. That was rough for him, I'm sure.
Yeah, but so it's interesting. Do you believe that American politics should mirror more of kind of what, I guess, Canada has, right? They have about five parties, I think, in their Congress, and it's a little bit more leveled out that way, I think. Do you think that America should adopt something more like that, or do you think the two-party system is kind of still the way to go?
Well, I wouldn't say that the two-party system is ingrained in our Constitution or the way our legislature is set up. Mm-hmm. It's just how it's become. It's just become a duopoly. These two major parties have just have enough support and have enough money behind them to where they can really get out there. I believe in England, they've just vote for a party, and I think Canada's mirrored like this as well. They just vote for the party, or they vote for a particular candidate in the party. I'm not 100% sure, but like each party would have, I guess, an opportunity, to have, control. So I guess like 23% liberal, 40 conservative, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think with that system, it's just set up so much differently than ours, where we just vote directly for representatives. Mm-hmm. I would actually have to look up really how their system works now that I think about it. But I think our system's fine. I think the way we go about voting for representatives and senators is fine, and it's changed much more than it was at the beginning. Like we would not even vote for senators to represent us in the Senate in D.C. Mm-hmm. originally. And this wasn't until like 1913, I think there was a constitutional amendment passed to where we would then finally vote for directly our state senator, our senators that represent the state. Originally, most of our senators were state appointed. Mm-hmm. The state governments would appoint the senators, and then they'd go to D.C. We've always been able to vote for our Congress members. But, I don't think we should necessarily change the system. I think we just – those other parties just need more opportunities to get themselves out there on a national platform, since they're at a financial deficit. And, a lot of people have that mindset of the two-party system where there can only be the two options. And, like I said earlier, anybody else who's voting for a different party is just throwing their vote away and giving it to the other party. I think Americans just really have to change their mindsets away from a two-party system, because we also used to have multiple candidates on it wasn't on a national platform, and the debates really developed through our nation's history, but multiple people used to be able to run for president and get that attention. Like Abraham Lincoln was mm-hmm. technically a third-party candidate. Mm-hmm. Republican Party was new at the time, and there were, I believe, three or four people running for president that year.
Another thing that I think you really touched on well was just the media attention in regards to the certain election cycles, And with this one especially, I guess I'm a little worried that we'll have a repeat of 2016 in terms of how candidates not only talk about the other party, but, you know, like the voters themselves. I think Joe Biden has actually been on the record saying that he doesn't even need the millennials to vote for him. Like, he doesn't even need that. What's your kind of reaction to, at least more so, the Democratic candidates kind of putting voters down that they actually could use to strengthen their campaigns?
Well, I just feel as if the Democratic Party is much more divided than, especially in 2016. I feel like though I don't necessarily support Bernie Sanders, I feel as if he got screwed over in 2016. I thoroughly believe that. I think there was some stuff going on behind the scenes that we didn't know. And it might end up being, like you said, the same as 2016, where that happens even with Joe Biden. But I feel like the voter base, or the younger voter base of the Democratic Party, is starting to shift more and more to left. And I think that's just kind of what's happening, where there's just this division where just the party leadership the party leadership is not marketing well to the younger voters in mm-hmm. their party. And I feel like that's not going to bode well for them this election. I don't know what Bernie will do if he doesn't get the nomination. I don't know if he'll end up supporting whoever. Well, I guess it's him and Joe Biden as of today, right? It's
just right. Those two.
Yeah. So he might do what he did in 2016 and pledge his support to the main nominee if he doesn't get the nomination. Or he might just do his own thing. That could be a difference that we might see this year. I believe that could happen. Now, of course, there's a lot on the line. You know, Trump's up for re-election. Trump's the Republican nominee. I think it's easy to say that there are people who are running against him, but I haven't seen anything about any of the other people running for the nomination.
Right.
I think Bill Weld and Mark Sanford, who were trying to also get the Republican nomination, but they haven't. I don't even know if they did any debates or anything. But I just think that they're out of touch. The party, if the Democrat Party leadership, they're just out of touch with their voter base, and that's going to end up nipping them in the bud if they don't start to appeal to them more.
I know, and it's so, I feel like the Democratic Party leadership, again, going back to that point, they always just blame the wrong things, right? They never want to take a look at themselves, right? So they'll blame people who vote third party. Oh, if you vote third party, you're essentially voting for Trump, or they'll blame millennials. And I just don't understand why they always play the blame game instead of just critically looking at themselves and seeing, oh, what can we do to enhance our voter turnout?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And it's tough too when there's just ideological differences. I mean, your candidate, whoever the candidate ends up being, they might not want to give up. They might not want to support policies that the younger voters might enjoy. They might not want to support the Medicare for All or the free college tuition or whatever. They might not want to move in that direction. And I feel like there's just, that part of it's just the ideology, the ideological divide might just hurt the party in the end. They might not be able to do anything about it. So I don't know. And I just don't. And it's the same thing with the Republican Party. I could see myself voting more Republican if they weren't starting to become more and more radical. I feel like that's the main issue, is just that there are more and more radical candidates on either side, and it's really hard to find a good middle ground. Donald Trump is an appealing candidate, or at least he was attractive in 2016 because he could get people watching the debates. That was a big part of it. It was entertaining. I watched every Republican debate just because I really wanted to see what Donald Trump was going to do this time. Movie is going to make fun of what new nicknames he had for people. And it's frightening that that's what it's starting to become. But I feel like the Republican Party is going to eventually run into the same issue, especially after 2024. You know, if Donald Trump gets reelected and everything, they're going to have to find another candidate like him. And that might scare voters away. And that's why I think the third parties got to focus on is the people who are disenfranchised from the other two major parties.
Mm.
And maybe offer more middle ground solutions. But I remember the Republican Party was not fully behind Donald Trump. And like Ted Cruz, I remember, he talked some pretty mad game. He said some pretty bad things about Donald Trump, but at the end of the day, he ended up supporting them. And I think that's just going to have to be the difference this time around, is that if you're a major player in your party and you don't support your party's nomination, I mean, you just really, you gotta stand up for it. Like, if Bernie doesn't get the nomination, if he gets robbed again, I think the only way to create actual change, though it might cost us this election, cost the Democrats this election, he would have to, you know, stand up and say, hey, like, stop doing this. This is, you know, this is what I believe in, and I have plenty of supporters in the party who are behind me.
Mm-hmm. So, no, and I think
my actual change is going to happen is if people really start breaking away from this two-party system.
Mm. No, and I think you're completely right. I think you at first Donald Trump didn't have that support, but then once he became the nominee, it was like, you know, full speed ahead. We are with Donald, and we are completely supporting him 100%. And the Democrats, I feel as though, still to this day, are not doing that, even with the candidates who are still just running, right? Hillary Clinton saying she would never support Bernie Sanders, even if he was the nominee. It's just like, I don't understand why, you know, they say Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love. I don't see why Democrats just can't fall in line either, you know?
Yeah. I'm not really sure on why, the Republicans fell in line so much easier behind Donald Trump. Like Rand Paul ended up supporting Donald Trump, ended up nominating him. And, mm-hmm. you know, in the debates, it did not seem like, you know, they would ever be able to do that. And it wasn't just with Paul. It was with, like I said earlier, Cruz, Kasich. Actually, I don't know if Kasich might not have endorsed Donald Trump. I don't remember. Yeah. But, I mean, most of the candidates up there were pretty belligerent towards each other, and then they ended up falling in line. So I'm not sure what the difference is there. I'd really prefer if they didn't fall in line. if we held him more accountable, I feel like better things would happen. Because really, if you look at Donald Trump, especially his actions in the past 4 years, there were some promises he might have fulfilled, but overall, there was still a deficit.
Right.
There was still a deficit. I mean, if you look at it, he passed more gun control legislation than Barack Obama did in his 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
With the bump stop ban, the talking about suppressor bans, things along those lines. He's not a very pro-gun president. And for whatever reason, like back in 2016, he received an A+ rating from the NRA.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't understand how a Republican voter can look at Donald Trump and look at his actions in the past 4 years and, you know, think he's a Republican, because for the longest time he wasn't even a Republican. Like, before he got at the main political stage, he was a Democrat, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
You can find pictures of him with Hillary Clinton at dinners and campaign things and everything. So I don't know.
No,
interesting to see people just, like you said, fall in line, even though they might not even support some of the things the main party stands for.
Yeah, no, and I completely agree with you in that fact, too. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about you is the fact that you do really call out both sides of the political spectrum and hold everybody accountable across the board. Like, you know, you constantly post news articles calling out, you know, certain Democratic things and even Republican things. And I think that would make a lot of people upset, because there's this notion that you can't even attack members of your own party, no matter how bad of something they did. Why do you think that people hold that regard?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you repeat that last part?
Yeah. So why do you think people hold their party in such high esteem that they can't even, you know, raise concerns about their own party when things come up? Like, in regards to what you had mentioned before,
I feel like a big problem is that people generally hold their political beliefs too close into their personal identity.
Mm.
So when their political beliefs are criticized, they don't just hear the criticism of their political beliefs; they hear themselves getting criticized. And I feel like when they see somebody in their party doing something wrong or somebody representing the Republican Party, Democrat Party, whatever, they don't want to call them out because, you know, they don't want to see these people do wrong, or they don't want to look bad for supporting these people. They don't want to look like they got duped. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think if people really stepped back and disassociated their political beliefs from their identity, I think a lot more discussion could be held. You know, because and back on what you said about me criticizing either side and making either side really mad. I've been called a Democrat and a Republican and a socialist and a Nazi in the same day, just for supporting different things. And I think, I had this buddy who shared something, and I was actually agreeing with him in the context, but one of his other friends saw me, and I don't even think they read my comment because it was a more controversial thing. I don't even think they read my comment and immediately, fired at me saying blah blah blah, you don't care about this, blah blah blah, and then they'll always go to my Facebook page and check out everything, and so they'll see social science education, and that's my major at Wright State. They'll see social science education and immediately think of if I was what they would call a useless degree. So you know, oh, you're just a gender studies major, blah blah blah, throwing out your money on this degree. So they won't even, they hear what I believe, they see my political beliefs, and they immediately think they know everything about me. And I just think that just goes back to people having their political identities so heavily vested in their personal identities. And I feel like that's just what we need to change.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I was I looked up a video the other day of this Republican speaker at this college. And I remember this guy was asking him, he said, well, you know, my girlfriend is a liberal, and do you think that we should continue to date? And, you know, I don't know, people say it was staged or whatever, but the guy ended up going into detail saying that basically, you know, your political beliefs are your personal beliefs, and that having a relationship with someone who is opposite of you politically would never work. It sounds to me, at least, that you don't believe that.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that. I've never been, the relationships I have been in, we've generally agreed. And there are some things that I feel like, yeah, if you disagree on it and you're going to fight about it all the time, maybe it won't work too well. But overall, I have plenty of friends who disagree with me on everything. But we're civil about it. We just don't bring it up if we can't really, fight about it. You know, you and I don't agree on everything, but we can sit here and have this very pleasant conversation. And I feel like that's the same with a lot of my friends. If you can't be friends with somebody that you don't agree with or believe with, then you just need to take a step back and chill out, I guess, is what I would say. I feel as if I could date somebody who disagree with me on a lot of things. Now, of course, we'd have to see how that really plays out. And I guess maybe things would get fired up closer to elections or where something major in the political realm happens. So, you know, I have not, like I said, I've really never had that experience, but I feel as if I could. Because overall, that's not, you know, what a relationship is all about. Just because you're never going to agree with anybody on everything. And it might help sometimes, but also it's kind of boring to be with somebody that you agree with everything on. You know, you might run out of things to talk about. you can only talk about how much you agree with each other so much. I feel like you know, there needs to be a little spice in there.
No, that's perfect. No, I completely agree. I have a lot of friends who fall on various political spectrums, and it's a lot of my liberal friends just can't understand how I even get along with them. And it's well, you know, friendship is based more than just your political beliefs. If we're all gonna sit around and talk about Elizabeth Warren all day, count me out. But so let's focus more on the current political election cycle that's taking place this year. Personally, I'll share this myself, and I'll kind of ask your opinion as an analyst too. I believe that if the Democrats decide to choose Joe Biden as the nominee, what I'm afraid will happen is that we'll have a similar situation to 2016, where they're trying to play it safe with the more moderate candidate and more independently minded people, or, you know, people who fall within that conservative category. I think we'll just end up voting for Trump between Trump and Biden, because he is the Republican. And I guess what worries me is the fact that I think Joe would win the popular vote, but again, I think he would lose the Electoral College, especially in those key states where during his time as a senator, he really kind of screwed a lot of the working class over, in a sense, with a lot of his policies that he enacted. What are your thoughts on a Biden-Trump primary?
Well, I can tell you that the debates would be the most entertaining event on television ever. I just think, you know, overall, I feel like Biden would be the safer choice for the Democratic Party. But I still don't think a lot of conservatives, maybe less Trump-minded people, would vote for him. I think he's too similar to Hillary in a lot of ways. And I saw an article. I'm not sure how true this is. It might have been clickbait. I didn't click on it. I was just kind of scrolling through. But it mentioned that Biden might look for a Republican running mate, which would be interesting. Good luck finding a Republican in the most time that would be willing to probably sacrifice their membership to run with the Democrat. I guess maybe Bill Weld. I don't know. He doesn't really care about parties. I could see Bill Weld maybe being his VP. But it's tough. I'm not really sure, because, you know, nobody thought Donald Trump would win in 2016, and then, you know, boom, he did it, and he got all those electoral votes and everything. It's hard for me to guess or predict. I thought Bloomberg was going to stay at it till the very end. I thought, yeah. I honestly, Bloomberg was going to pull a Ross Perot type thing, where he would just run as an independent after the main candidate was chosen. And I'm surprised he dropped out. But he's definitely going to be supporting whoever. I think. And did he pledge to Biden? Did he?
He did endorse Biden. Yeah.
Okay, well, now they have a lot more funding, so that might be the difference this year, is that there's, you know, more money behind it. So I guess we'll see. If I really had to guess, I think Trump will take it again. I feel like people, he's just really, really gotten out there, and he's good at getting people riled up, which is unfortunate. But yeah, I really think Trump will take it, really, no matter who the nominee is. I think the Democrats will have a better chance with Joe Biden, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, talk about money. I mean, the last election, Trump nearly did not spend anything close to what Hillary Clinton spent on advertising. Yeah. And I think it just goes to show that with just a strong message and a fired up base, you really can get anything accomplished. And I think, to me, it's just upsetting, because it's like, Joe, really, he's like our champion, like the guy who can't even remember what he's talking about in the same sentence, let alone he's insulting his own supporters at his town halls, and like, this is the guy we're running with, like.
Well, and then I think our candidates are just becoming too old. I just don't feel like the youth is being represented enough. I don't know, like everybody up on that stage. I think after Pete Buttigieg, or however you say his last name, when he dropped out, I think Biden became the youngest one in the race. Well, I guess Tulsi Gabbard, but I guess the main contenders. I feel like as youth, we should try to represent. I mean, I believe Obama was the youngest elected president ever, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
And, you know, he brought a lot of charisma, and he wasn't very divisive, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And I think overall that's our problem, is just everybody's so divided. But, I think our candidates are just becoming too old.
And speaking of even just younger voters, I was looking up a really sad statistic today about the primaries cast so far. And it is 10% of 18 to 30-year-olds. Only 10% of registered voters have voted for a candidate.
Oh my gosh! You said how many? What percent?
10%. So that means, and that's just registered voters between the ages of 18 to 30.
Oh my goodness.
So 90% of our generation is not even showing up to have their vote heard. Like, what do you think about when you hear that statistic?
I mean, it's sad because it's not that hard to register to vote as far as it, and especially like on campus of Wright State, we have a whole organization that's geared towards getting people registered to vote and, you know, giving people the resources to find out, you know, what they need to do if they need to cast like an absentee ballot and stuff like that, like when dates are important, primary dates, important, you know, election dates and everything. And I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's just because the youth feel disenfranchised. Maybe they don't feel like there's any hope for them. I'll vote. Like, I'm going to vote, and usually my friends, for the most part, are planning on voting, my friends my age. But I'm not really sure why the youth seem so disinterested in voting anymore. I mean, with the popular vote, I feel like people hear that, you know, Hillary won the popular vote, Trump won the electoral vote, the popular vote didn't matter. The popular vote's still important, you know, because Trump still needed people to vote for him to get the electoral votes. But yeah, I'm not specifically sure why the youth feel so disenfranchised.
Yeah, I was definitely trying to look into that more today too, and it reminds me of a conversation I had with someone previously on a podcast where we were talking about even just our education. And at least where I went to school, you know, it wasn't required to have a civics class. We didn't have a government class that was necessarily required. And, you know, I personally didn't even know there were three branches of government until I was in high school, which is sad. So I don't know. Can you speak to your education and how, you know, your school may have prepared you for, you know, the political world outside?
Well, I feel like my school did an okay job at it. We were required to take a government class, which was good, and I learned quite a bit in it. And that was actually around election time. I guess I voted my senior year of high school, so my junior year went through a full year of government. Usually, the juniors would take government. And then they offered like a constitutional law class. That was another big thing that you could take. That part wasn't required, but you could still take it. So I feel like as far as requirements go, I mean, a government class is a good idea. Like, I want to be a government teacher, history and government teacher. But, you know, overall, you can give kids all the classes they want, but that doesn't mean they're going to necessarily be interested in it. And I think that's part of it as well. I'm sure there are plenty of people I went to school with and that have gone through the program, who have gone and taken their government or civics class and came out knowing just about as much as they knew and they went in. So I just feel like also some people aren't interested in the political process, which is a shame, because everybody's got skin in the game. You know, it affects everybody. So, yeah. And I guess the idea would be just to find ways to get people more and more interested in government, civics, politics, and also make sure they're make sure that they're at least somewhat educated on it. So I think most certainly a government class should be mandatory, like a mandatory standard for everybody to take. But overall, like I said, you can't force the students to be interested in it. I mean, if they're just not, they're not.
Yeah. So in your mind, what would an ideal government look like? If you could tear everything down and rebuild it up again, what would a Mark government, how would it operate?
Like in a perfect world or in
perfect world? Perfect world. You get full control.
Well, if we're talking absolute perfection, I don't believe a government would be necessary. But I guess being more practical about it, the federal government, we'd have the same constitution, we'd have the same basic setup. The federal government would be responsible for military, for enforcing law, and, you know, protecting some of our international interests, though minimal they might have to be. And then the states basically taking care of state issues, so education, things like that, more state power, less federal centralized power, I guess. Mm. Overall, minimal taxation, and minimal regulation, and just really let the people be, I guess. Just let people govern themselves. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like that's where a lot of our problems have stemmed from, is just overreaching federal government and overreaching state government in a lot of cases. Yeah. Just think of Ron Swanson. that's the best way I can. What would Ron Swanson's ideal government be? That'd be my ideal government.
So let me then push back a little bit and say, okay, so we have this in place, and there are people who start to rise up who are more powerful. They have control of a lot of things, and they begin to take advantage of that, right? And let's say somebody owns a car manufacturer, and there's no regulations that say, you know, that you have to install airbags or seatbelts, and they do this, they cut it out because it saves money. You know, sure. What do you say in that instance where it's like, oh, at that point they have total control to do what they want, but yet we're severely lacking in these things that we've just become accustomed to and that we probably need to just be safe in general?
Yeah, sure. And the government would be responsible for making sure there was no misinformation going around like they are now, like preventing from false advertising. So before an individual would buy the car, they would be aware that, hey, this doesn't include all these safety features, or this doesn't include everything you might want in it. Mm. So I guess, you know, don't buy the car if you want airbags or a seatbelt. Maybe have like a list of standards, like, hey, this is the ideal safe vehicle, and maybe publish that through some publication, make that information available, but ultimately let people decide whether or not they want to drive a car with an airbag in it or seatbelts in it. As crazy as that might sound, you know, just let people decide for themselves, I guess, what kind of risks they want to take. And then hopefully people are well-educated enough to understand that, hey, you should definitely buy a car with an airbag in it and seatbelts. But not everybody would be.
Mm-hmm. And then what would happen in the case where somebody, maybe economically, they're working just, you know, a job where they just don't make a lot of money, and the only car they can afford is one that doesn't come with like an airbag or seatbelt? Like, what do you say then? Should there be like a regulation that states that, you know, that everybody should have equal opportunity to get the vehicle of their choice, even though the cost may be different? Or
overall, I mean, I'm not. It's hard with hypotheticals. Mm-hmm. Specifically, even if a car manufacturer would sell a car without an airbag or safety belt, especially knowing, you know, the issues with it and everything, you know, I don't know if that would even be an issue. I'm not even sure if those kind of vehicles would be sold. Mm-hmm. But I guess an individual who might not make enough to afford a car like that, I guess that's a tough question that I'm not sure I'm able to answer.
No, and that's totally fine. It's just
I
often struggle too with, because I think I do fall a lot in line with even how you think in certain situations, but then it's like I just anticipate that people aren't necessarily, they don't always have the best interest in mind when it comes to their peers, and so I worry that in a society like that, people may take advantage of the people who are less than or the have-nots in that instance.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that would definitely happen where there might be misinformation or, you know, more impoverished people that might not be able to afford the better, safer equipment. But hopefully there'd be also people who would, you know, push to make that stuff more affordable, or even provide charitable acts or sums of money that could go towards making these people safe. Like I just saw the news the other night about John Legend in Springfield. Mm. You know, that Kroger closed downtown, and he's going to be offering transportation out of the food desert. Mm-hmm. So that people can go and buy from outside grocery stores, or like other altruistic things, like Elon Musk, he he released all the patents and things for his electric cars, mm-hmm. And technology. So hopefully in that kind of society, there'd be people who are altruistic and charitable enough to spread that kind of information and assist those who are less fortunate.
No, yeah, and that's definitely a great mindset to have, too. I definitely love the optimism. And so I guess closing out, I want to focus just on one more topic, healthcare, which seems to be a pretty important topic. Even just now, I was reading an article today about how a lot of Republicans are even considering maybe not so much a revamp of the healthcare system, but ways to give more people access to it, especially in the wake of this new virus that's spreading, right? Like, what is your view on healthcare itself? Is it a right that should be instilled to every citizen when they're born, like the right to free speech and owning a gun? Or is it something that, you know, should continue to operate in the private sector as we have it now?
Well, I don't believe the way we're running healthcare right now is a good thing, a good, efficient way of running it. Overall, no, I do not believe that anybody has the right to healthcare because it is technically somebody else's service. I don't believe that you have the right to somebody else's service. I believe you have the right to own a firearm, but I do not believe somebody has to provide the firearm for you. That's the same. I believe right to free speech, but nobody has to provide, your megaphone or, whatever else you need to do free speech with. Of course, healthcare is different from free speech or the right to bear arms because everybody does need healthcare. And I would just look at the insurance model as a whole. And I'd recommend this YouTube video to you. It's a John Stossel YouTube video. You could look up grocery insurance. And in this video, he just talks about how bad really our insurance model is and like how it just drives up prices. Healthcare is expensive for a multitude of different reasons. And I think a big reason is the FDA. The FDA having a lot of different requirements and monetary requirements and things along those lines to get a new drug made, processed, and passed. If you're a pharmaceutical scientist who's developing a new drug, you're going to spend your entire career on just that one drug because it literally costs millions to even billions of dollars to get these drugs out on the market. And that alone drives up the price. And then we have issues with patent laws and things like that, like with the EpiPen guy. He was the only one at one point with the patent and the ability to make the EpiPen. And eventually the patent expired or somebody was allowed to make a alternative version of it. What was that called? A generic brand version of it that was much cheaper and much more affordable. And it's tricky with the healthcare industry because, people's health's at stake. People's lives are often at stake. So we just have to look at how we can get healthcare prices lower. And I think part of it would be to repeal a lot of regulations and really pull back, make sure it's more affordable, lower the barriers to entry into things like the drug market and into becoming a physician and everything like that. I think that's a good start. And looking at the insurance model, the insurance companies have such a huge stake in Washington right now to where they have a vested interest in keeping healthcare at the expensive nature that it's at right now. They want to keep it less affordable because they make a lot more money that way. And people are going to need insurance to get specific procedures and things like that done. One other thing that drives up the price, and this is a major factor as well, is Medicare and Medicaid. Now, of course, those are important institutions that provide health care to a lot of people, but their existence is basically like a government subsidy. And whenever you subsidize something, the price of it's going to go up. The quantity of it's going to go up, but the price of it's going to go up as well. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those are major factors on why health care has gotten so expensive. I mean, before even the early 2000s, there were, they still exist, charitable hospitals, organizations that could afford to give basically free care or very cheap care to people. A lot of it was through the Catholic Church, but a lot of that just can't exist anymore because healthcare has become so expensive. Yeah. And you know, him, like Bernie Sanders, I really like this from him. He talked about importing prescription drugs because in other countries, these prescription drugs aren't as expensive. Now, one I guess, positive effect of the expense of making these drugs is it's also massively profitable to make them. So we have seen medical advances and drug advances. But, you know, at what cost if people can't afford health care? If we're out of luck. But overall, we just need to look at how to lower the prices of healthcare. And I think not necessarily ditching the insurance model, but changing up how we do deductibles and things like that would help. I know, I think it's through some grocery store, Whole Foods or something. They have like a health savings account with high deductible insurance where some of their paycheck goes to a health savings account and then the rest of it's towards their higher deductible insurance. So they're ready if they have to go pay for a large procedure or something like that. But insurance used to only be for catastrophe issues. So you get in a car accident, you have your health insurance and you're going to be in the hospital for a while. Or if you get cancer or something, you're going to have, after you meet your deductible, you're going to have the insurance cover a lot of it. It used to be catastrophe based. Now people use their insurance to go for regular doctor's visits. Now, of course, those doctor visits are expensive and it'd be difficult to afford them if you didn't have the money. I mean, if you didn't have money set aside for that. But another issue is this with a lot of these like doctor's offices and hospitals, a lot of times they don't even set their own prices. It's the insurance companies who set the prices. So if you call into a doctor's office tomorrow and say, hey, how much does a well check cost? They're going to have to go through a lot of paperwork and things to find it. And also most doctors and physicians at private practices have to hire 2 to 3 people just to deal with all the insurance paperwork because they don't have the time to do it themselves because they have to see patients. So a lot of this just factors into this big mess where healthcare is an incredibly expensive industry. And I feel as if a lot of it we could pin on the insurance industry and the government.
No, yeah. And thank you for sharing that. You definitely made a lot of really good points just even about our current system and ways we can just even small ways we can improve. Like we don't have to completely revamp it, but we definitely need, I think we need to do something, right?
100%.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, Mark, for just agreeing to be on. I was really looking forward to actually interviewing you. When I was thinking about making this podcast, you were honestly one of the first ones to come to mind just because of your views. And I do believe that we are kind of operating more toward a place where other parties and other systems do seem more appealing. I don't believe that this two-party system necessarily is going to be in place forever. And so, yeah, thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. And thank you again for listening, everyone.